Good evening, good morning, wherever you may be. Thank you for tuning in to the best in overnight talk radio. It's Halloween for some of you just wrapping up, for others of you already well past Halloween. But thank you for spending your evening here with me. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader. And remember, it's time to set back your clocks tonight. We got to fall back. And firefighters around the United States have contacted me during the show. And they said, please remind people this is the perfect time to check your smoke alarms and change the batteries. As a matter of fact, they're trying to get everybody into the practice of using Fallback as their annual reminder to test and replace batteries because it could save a life. So for daylight savings time, now it's time to go check those batteries and make sure that everything's up to date. Thank you very much for being with us this evening. And I've got something great. We've been doing for the last 7 years on our show, Darkness Radio, what we call Halloween for Hunger. And Coast to Coast AM was kind enough to allow us to extend this into the programming this evening. We did a live 3-hour broadcast of Darkness Radio earlier tonight and rolled right into Coast to Coast AM. We're raising money for Second Harvest Heartland, which services over 900 food shelves across the United States, helping our neighbors, friends, and loved ones right here in the good old U.S. of A. And this is what you can do to help. A donation of even a dollar. $1 will provide 3 meals for a person in need. $5 supplies around 19 meals for a person in need. And if you have the wherewithal to make a $100 donation, it will go to help feed a family of four for 1 month. $100 feeds a family of four for an entire month. It's really easy to do. Just go right to our website, darknessradio.com. There's a banner for our Halloween charity. Click it. It'll take you through. It'll allow you to make your donation using PayPal, credit card, or checking account, and you'll be able to make a huge difference in the life of your neighbors, friends, and loved ones here in the United States. Again, even something as little as $1 will definitely provide 3 meals for somebody in need. So please go make any size donation. You can do it anonymously where we don't know how much you donated or what your name is, so you can go feel comfortable making any size donation to this cause. It would go a long way to help us for Halloween for Hunger and be a part of the Coast audience and Darkness Radio audience coming together to provide for those in our communities. All right, tonight we've got 2 more hours lined up for you. Raising Hell. That's what we're going to be talking about, a concise history of the black arts and those who dared to practice them. Robert Masello, my guest. Stay tuned. That continues next on Coast to Coast AM. We're back here on Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host this evening, Dave Schrader, and my guest now, Robert Masello. He's written a book that really entranced me, the idea behind it, and communicating, understanding what goes on with necromancy, sorcery, astrology, alchemy, prophecy. And he's agreed to join us for the next couple of hours. We'll talk about his first book, which came out a few years back, and is entitled Raising Hell, A Concise History of the Black Arts and Those Who Dared to Practice Them. Next hour, we'll talk about his compendium book to that, Fallen Angels and Spirits of the Dark. Welcome to Coast AM, Robert Masello. Thank you, Robert.
Oh, nice to be here, and happy Halloween.
Well, happy Halloween, and thank you for spending the time with us this evening. Let me ask you, I mean, what got you intrigued in this aspect of research?
You know what? I can blame my mother for this.
Okay.
She was always interested in, gothic stories and horror and Dracula and Frankenstein, and she raised me on that stuff. And even though it's not something that I make a great practice of, it's still something that really always intrigued me, and I ended up writing about it. Many of my books I wrote just to kind of, please my mom. And it's just something that I always thought was kind of interesting, intriguing, and mysterious.
But looking into the darker aspects of it, was that something that as you started to educate yourself on it, did it unnerve you digging in? Was this something that you started to think, maybe this is not something I should dig too deeply into?
No, not really. But it is funny that I do end up writing about a lot of this stuff late at night, which is probably not the best idea.
Right.
Because, in fact, just before you called, there was a scratching at the door, the French doors to my office here. And I look up and I see these two yellow eyes. It's the neighbor's cat that came across the balcony that occasionally comes to visit. And of all nights, of course, it came tonight just before the radio show. So somewhere around my apartment, Watson the cat is lurking right now. I let him in. But I just always yeah, just had this kind of interest in it. I had an interest in the literature, chiefly the books like Dracula and Frankenstein, which are really wonderful pieces of literature, which, you know, people forget because all they remember is Boris Karloff and Bela Lugosi movies. Great as those were. But the original stories themselves had a lot of power in them. And they bring up questions for all of us, I think, of, you know, just kind of, you know, what is real, what is not, what's beyond the realm of our senses, if anything, and how do we explore that if it is there?
Well, this, as we said in the opening, this has captured the attention of people, you know, from ancient Babylon to today. Why do you think people are so fascinated by this topic?
Well, because people have always wondered, you know, about the mysteries of the cosmos. It's all the big questions get wrapped up in this stuff, such as, you know, why are we here? What's our purpose in life? And what is there after this, if anything? I mean, I think it's that great fear of the dark and the unknown that's been addressed in all of these legends and all of these myths. We're always trying to come up with some kind of rationale for why the crops wither or why the sun shines when it does or where storms come from or why we are given just a certain period of time upon this earth. All of those are questions that the mythology and the legends and the lore, and a lot of it is, you know, some of it's black magic, some of it's white. All of these things are the same questions that those address. And so people have always been interested in those and always will be.
Well, talk to me about the theories behind, as you said, black magic and white magic. I mean, what is the difference between those two type of evocations?
Well, the white magic would be things that a lot of the Wiccans, for instance, would say that's what they really do. It's magic that they use for purposes of good, and black magic, of course, is for purposes of evil. Now, when you were doing, for instance, in both of those, something that's very important to all kinds of magic is the sacred circle. The circle is the simplest geometrical kind of, you know, symbol. It is at once everything is encompassed by a circle, and yet there's nothing in the middle of it. So for all of the incantations and the rituals, if you were doing white magic, for instance, you made a circle around yourself, and you made it going in the direction of east to west. But if you wanted to go Widdershins, if you wanted to go the other way, that would make it the circle. If you drew the circle the other direction, then that was going to be used for black magic. And they would sometimes position along the sides of the circle all the letters of the alphabet, whichever language they were speaking, so that they could then later alight upon those and get a reading from the other world. But if you're moving in the right direction, the direction of the sun, and it's normal progress, you're practicing white magic and black magic, you would be going always against nature. That's the idea, that you're going against the natural order of things is the, you know, the purpose and the methodology of black magic. And that would be to, you know, invoke the dark forces, which I write about in books like Raising Hell and Fallen Angels, you know, the demons, the spirits of the dark, that sort of thing.
To communicate, do you find in the older writings all the way through to today, are there common threads which just have never changed through the times, or did they always seem to adapt to what was available in those time eras?
You know what, that's a really great question, because things really do, there is a common thread, and it's always being adapted, and it always has been. I mean, even Halloween, which we're celebrating tonight, was originally a Celtic festival many, many centuries ago, and it was spelled Samhain, but it's actually pronounced Samhain. And what happens is, you know, when the Christian faith came along, what it did was it co-opted a lot of, this was traditional, this was how things always worked, it co-opted a lot of the pagan rituals and a lot of the Celtic rituals in this case, and turned them into something that they could use for their own religion, so that what happened to Samhain became All Hallows' Eve, and it became a Saint's Day. And then the next day, November 2nd, became All Souls' Day. It's why we have Christmas on December 25th. That date for Christmas was just chosen arbitrarily to coincide with a lot of usual heathen pagan dates that revolved around things like the seasons, the harvest, all of that. And the idea was to insert a Christian context there.
and tried to get people away from the pagan rituals and more into focusing on God for the Christian versions.
Yes, I mean it was very clever, and I mean a lot of the early Christian leaders figured that out, that when you were trying to convert people, when you were trying to make them understand what your message was, if you just, you know, if they worshipped a certain kind of tree and you just cut it down, you would tick them off and you wouldn't exactly win them over. The idea then was to incorporate that tree and that kind of worship or that kind of ritual into a Christian context, and eventually we even got Christmas trees that way. And in fact, they changed the oak, which was once decorated by the Germanic tribe, the Chatti, C-H-A-T-T-I, that was replaced with an evergreen. And the idea was the church leaders taught the Germans that the evergreen tree, look at the shape of it. It aspires toward heaven. It's like a missile directed at the sky. So they incorporated the idea of a tree, but they just changed the tree and they gave it a Christian context and a Christian meaning.
Fascinating the way people manipulate or kind of mold what they want into making sense into whatever their, you know, derivation of the story should be.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Bible, I know, has been quoted in many different ways, but, you know, we shouldn't communicate with the dead. There shouldn't be necromancy, yet there are many people in the Bible that speak to the dead and seek counsel from the dead or from others. And, you know, it kind of becomes a confusing mix. When you're looking at the history of communication and necromancy and such, how far back does it go? And what about those rituals do you find, you know, were considered to be very powerful? And do you believe that they were speaking to the dead? Were they speaking to gods with a little g? What were they dealing with?
Well, as the old joke goes, it's easy to speak to the dead. The hard part's getting them to speak to you.
Right.
I mean, people go, I can talk to the dead. Well, hell, I can do that too. We all can do that. Getting an answer is the hard part. But when you look at things like necromancy, which is, of course, you know, the raising of the dead to speak to them, that goes way back. You've got stories of that in the Old Testament. And the idea with necromancy is that the dead have passed over to another realm, and yet they still exist there. And now they're in possession of all kinds of knowledge and wisdom, and whether that's questions you have about, you know, the nature of God, the cosmos, existence, or if it's something a lot more tangible and, frankly, you know, a little less elevated, a lot of times it was thought that the dead knew where buried treasure was hidden in the earth. So there was this race on all the time for figuring out ways to bring back the dead so that they could tell you where the gold was hidden, or they could give you some kind of divination of the future. They could tell you, you know, what was going to happen. There's a famous case of a Greek ruler who summoned up a dead man, you know, and asked for, you know, the prophecy. And the dead man said, you know, tomorrow when you go to battle, a great empire will be destroyed. And the Greek ruler rejoiced. He was going to fight against the Persians. The only thing was the Persians won. The great empire that was destroyed was the Greek guys. So you got to be very careful how you read the messages that you are getting from the dead, if you are indeed getting them. But there were all kinds of incredible incantations and rituals devised over the years, including, you know, things like the Hand of Glory, which is one of the most famous. And the idea was to use either the dead themselves or pieces of the dead to gain knowledge of the future, to gain riches in this life, to gain even true love, bizarrely enough.
Right. There was actually just a story, I think, over the last day or two, where they were knocking down a wall and they found a Hand of Glory in the wall, which, if I understand, was a hanged criminal. They would cut the hand off, drain it of blood, do all of these ritualistic things in it in order to gain some kind of power from it.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yes. And the one thing I've never been able to ascertain, Davis, I've never been able to find out whether it was the right or the left hand of the hanged man, or whether it really didn't matter. Apparently, either hand would do. And this hand, yes, was drained of blood, and then you baked it in the oven, or if it was a very sunny climate, you could leave it out to dry in the sun. And the idea was you see replicas of it in you know, sort of, you know, novelty shops and things like that now, that it would cast a spell. I mean, it was used for all kinds of different things, supposedly. You could light the hand of glory. You lighted each fingertip so it looked like, you know, a candelabra in a way. And the idea was that while you had it lighted outside, all the inhabitants of the house, for instance, would fall into a deep slumber, and you could then, you know, climb through a window or go through the door and rifle the house. And, you know, there's a famous old case of a maid who noticed that the hand of glory was burning outside the master's house, and for some reason she hadn't been bewitched by it. Maybe she was out running some errands, and she tried desperately to douse the hand of fire, and she tried it with this thing and water and that, and finally nothing worked until she doused it with, for some reason, milk seemed to work. And the inhabitants of the house all immediately woke up, and the thief was caught red-handed, and the family was so grateful that I hope they gave her a raise. But
probably not, unfortunately, right?
You know, all of the stories are they kind of peter out at the end. You always want to say, and then what happened? One more thing. The maid was rewarded with what? A day off, I hope.
I love the incantation that came with it. Let those who rest more deeply sleep. Let those awake their vigils keep. O hand of glory, shed thy light. Direct us to your spoil tonight. So I love that criminals had a way to try to entrance people for this. And reading the article, I can't find any response as to which hand would have been better. It just said that the worse the crime, the more effective the magic. So if this was a really bad guy, and you could get that hand off, and you had to cut their hand off while they still hung from the gallows tree. And I'm sure at that point you had to be quick with it, so it was probably whichever hand you could get.
you take both hands. It's always good to have a spare.
Sure. I mean, of course.
How many times do people say to you, could you give me a hand? Wouldn't it be nice if you had one to spare?
We've got a really interesting story. If you go to TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, keyword darkness, you'll go in there, and right now on our site, we've got in the personality page there's a story in there about the glory hole hand that they found in the wall, and you can read all about it and read what magical principles it was and how it worked. It's right on our site. It's free, and it's available at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com, keyword darkness. It's funny that you bring that up, because literally they just found this mummified hand hidden in a wall of a Yorkshire cottage.
That's amazing. No, I haven't seen that story, and thank you for telling me. I'll check it out after this. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. It's so weird, all the things that they... How would you consider that these are the points that you need to do? Who first came up with these beliefs? You know, it's like, to get rid of this, you would have to get dirt from the graveyard of a freshly dug grave that was buried at this time and before this time on a full moon. And there are all of these crazy things that were involved in doing these principles of magic. It was never something simple, right? You didn't just go spit in a pond and ask for a favor. It always had to be at a certain time, and you had to turn, you know, semicircles backwards three times before doing it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. You had to be an adept. You had to be, you know, somebody who was skilled and versed in this stuff. But there were a lot of reasons for that, actually. One of the reasons was all of the incantations, all the rituals and the recipes were written in this unbelievably obfuscating and impossible to understand language. But one of the reasons for that was, you know, a lot of times if you were doing this kind of thing, you could get yourself at the very least interrogated, excommunicated,
right?
Tortured, mangled, mutilated, drawn and quartered, hanged, burned at the stake. So everything had to be kind of written in a language that supposedly only other people who were into divination or alchemy or necromancy or whatever it was, that they would understand. But at the same time, you're exactly right. Nobody could understand this stuff. There were certain kind of elements that appeared regularly. For instance...
We have to take a break. I don't want to get too much deeper in it. We'll come back and chat about that. It also makes you wonder, was it more about the intent? The more things you had to do proved your intention, that you were really set on making this happen. So did the magic have more to do with the more intricate it was, the more that you were sold into what you were doing, possibly the more powerful the intent was, that would be what would deliver you whatever it is you sought. We'll talk more with our guest. We've got another hour and a half with him. We'll open up phone lines a little bit later on in the show. Raising Hell, a concise history of the black arts and those who dared to practice them, right here on Coast to Coast AM. You've heard us talk about it on the show, ParanormalDate.com, your location to find like-minded individuals interested in all aspects of the paranormal, from ghosts to UFOs, cryptids, and more. You can go check out ParanormalDate.com, and it's become even easier for Android users. There's now an app available in the Google Play Store, and it's free. There's around 28,000 people and members that are involved in this right now, so go check it out. You may find your best friend, a new teammate to investigate with, and the love of your life. Go check out ParanormalDate.com. There's no reason to be alone in your interest in the supernatural anymore. And there's another great deal going on right now, BeyondBelief.com. Go check out www.BeyondBelief.com, George Norrie's TV show. A 1 month promotion. It's only 99 cents right now. So go check that out for Beyond Belief. If you like what you hear on Coast to Coast AM, you'll love what you see on Beyond Belief. And Coast Insiders, holidays are coming up. If you're looking for a perfect gift to give to somebody, you know, for a full year subscription to Coast AM, it's only 15 cents a day. And that gives you access to the last 5 years of archives, live chats with George Norrie and some of his guests, all the great news and information you can find right there. Go to coasttocoastam.com and become an insider, and you'll find out why we're the best in overnight talk radio. I'm Dave Schrader. We'll be back with more Coast to Coast AM right after this. Robert Micello has written a book talking about the history of occult arts, necromancy, sorcery, astrology, alchemy, prophecy, and we're talking about that right now. A little bit later on, we'll talk about his newer book, Fallen Angels and Spirits of the Dark. We'll do that at the top of next hour, and you'll be able to call in if you have questions for our guest and have some insights or questions you'd like him to answer. We can certainly cover that for you this evening. It's Halloween, and welcome to Coast AM. I'm your host, Dave Schrader. Thank you again for being here with us this evening, Robert. It's a great pleasure to have you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And if I may, one mystery just got cleared up during the commercial break. Remember
what
the
is
chap
that
came in when we first started talking?
Right.
I just found him. He's under the knee hole of my desk. I just stepped on him.
Oh, jeez.
Quite by accident, but I heard a meow, and there he is under there. I should have guessed.
Unless it's a bilocating cat, and you still hear the scratching outside the doors, right?
In which case, you're going to hear the sound of me running out the door in terror.
Have you ever, I mean, you do a lot of research into this and look into a lot of dark things. Have you ever had a creepy encounter yourself?
Yeah, I mean, I've certainly had those moments. There was a time many years ago when I was writing a story and I was really deeply into it. I was living at home with in my mother's house at the time, and I was writing about my grandfather's death. And there was, in the midst of that, a thump on the roof of our house in Chicago that startled us both awake. And I thought maybe the wind dislodged a tree branch or something. I couldn't figure out what had caused this. And I took a flashlight, and I actually went outside on the porch, and then I went around the house to see what could have hit the roof so hard and awakened my mom, and it startled me. We couldn't figure it out. But when I went back in the house, I also then smelled something. And in another room, we had a little old, it's hard to explain, but it was a little German replica of a house with a wire that we'd wired it so that there was an electric bulb inside it to light up the little cobbler inside. It was made to look like a little cobbler shop. And the wire had, I guess, frayed and started a fire on the carpeting. And there was a fire going in the den in that other room, which we would never have known about had we not been alerted by this incredible thump on the roof. And we were able to put the fire out in time before it really, you know, spread up beyond the den. But we never did figure out what it was that alerted us to that or what could possibly have caused that unearthly thump on the roof of the house. It was really spooky.
Definitely something warning you, it seems.
Yeah. No, I mean, I would not have noticed this otherwise. And I was deep into writing that story. But and there are those moments. I mean, I think when we read certain things, when I was a kid, I don't know if you've read this, but did you ever read Bram Stoker's Dracula when you were young and impressionable? I read that when I was like, I don't know, 12 or 13. And I just remember that was the first time I'd ever read a book where I was so scared I pulled my chair into the corner where there was nothing that could come up behind me and turned on all the lights. And I had to be able to look, you know, in all directions, nothing, you know, before I could continue to read that book. It was so terrifying to me. But I was
very young and impressionable at the age of 38 when I cracked that book open. And I wish I could get back to those innocent days. But I've been there with you. There was a book, it's written by Annie Wilder, called House of Spirits and Whispers, and it's based right here in Minnesota, her real-life encounter at this home. And I'll tell you, it's one of those few books that when I was reading it, I kept looking over the top of my book. My heart was racing, sweaty palms, and it was so intense in a few spots in this book. And I told her afterwards, I said, man, this book got into my head to the point where I was uncomfortable reading it, but I couldn't put it down.
Isn't that what's interesting, too, though, that we really, there's something in human nature that likes to be scared. We enjoy that sensation. Not everybody. I mean, I have certain members of my family even who will never read any of my novels or my nonfiction books about this stuff. But there are those of us who like it. We like I don't particularly like particularly graphic horror movies and stuff, but I like to be scared. I like that sensation of what's behind the door, that kind of terror. And in fact, they've done studies on why horror movies, for instance, are very popular with young people. It's not only because you're open to that kind of sensation, but going to a horror movie is great for couples who are dating because it allows both sexes to just practice the tried and true formulas. The girl, even if she's not scared at all, can pretend to be scared, and the guy, even if he's scared out of his mind, can pretend not to be and be brave. He gets to put his arm around the back of the chair. He gets to pretend to be really macho and in charge, and she gets to pretend, if she feels like it, you know, to need some solace and protection. You can go right back to the standard stereotypical roles, if you want to, on a date like that when you're a kid.
Yeah, well, and they've also proven that chemically, you bond to more people in those moments of fear, and then the relaxation of it's over, and it releases endorphins and all of this crazy stuff. Yeah, so they talk about these extreme dates and how putting yourself in these agitated states can actually connect you closer to people.
No, you know what? I'm not surprised at that, but I had not heard that before, so thank you. That's really interesting. Yeah, but that does make sense because also, yeah, when you come down together from, you know, the thing has jumped out of the closet or whatever it is, and then you get that release that you feel in an audience when you go to a movie like, you know, Paranormal Activity, any one of those. Those are really scary movies made for next to nothing.
Right, and they get into your head because, again, they're playing upon your darkest fears, right? Things we can't see, we can't control. You know, people will often ask me, what terrifies me about that aspect? I have children, and it's the fact if you have a burglar in the house, you have a chance of grabbing them by the throat and throwing them out or disabling them. Uh-huh. If there's something supernatural, you're kind of at a loss. You have no way to physically grab something like that. You have no way to overpower something that has the power to be unseen. And that's terrifying.
Yes. And the great movie makers and the great writers too know that what's scariest is the unseen. It becomes usually almost always less terrifying when it comes through the door. It was scariest when it was on the other side of the door and you just, and in a movie like The Haunting, the famous old movie, where you see the door swell and you hear the pounding of the thing outside, but you don't see it. What people can imagine is always more terrifying than anything you can actually then show them.
Right, which is what ended up with Spielberg's classic Jaws. Although the mechanical shark kept breaking down, it worked to their benefit because you didn't see it. You didn't see what was chasing them through this, and it was your imagination. It is funny how our minds can completely control how we experience something. And, you know, I love the paranormal. I love all facets of investigating it and researching it. And then you feel like you're starting to get a grasp on it. And I'll tell you, I mentioned this last week. I saw a show called Intrigue Theater, and they have a website, intriguetheater.com. This magician, illusionist, does this entire paranormal show, and he was just here in Minnesota. I think he just did a show out in Eureka Springs at the Crescent Hotel this tonight, and you look at what he's able to do and how easily your brain will accept these things as reality. And I think of all the places I've been and all the things I've experienced, and I wonder how easily was my mind tricked, and what I just experienced had nothing to do with the paranormal, but how my brain conceives what's going on around me.
Yes, yes. And if I could digress on the same topic, though, for just a second, there was a wonderful movie on earlier tonight on Turner Classic Movies, my favorite network, and I own no stock in that. I'm just saying that. Do you know a movie called Curse of the Demon with Dana Andrews? It's from, like, I don't know, probably 1958 or so.
Right, yeah.
But it's based on one of the great, great ghost stories of all time by my favorite ghost story writer of all time, M.R. James, Montague Rhodes James, who was an Englishman who wrote around, you know, in the early 1900s. And in that movie, Jacques Tourneur, the Frenchman, was the director of it. There was a big issue about whether you show the demon or not. And in the story, of course, you never see it. And in the original movie, and in the script and in what Tourneur shot, you didn't see the demon. All you saw was, you know, what was left afterwards. And you saw the terror on the face of the victim as the demon approached. But it was left to the viewer to conjure that up. And then a producer at the last moment decided that they really needed to start showing the demon right at the beginning and right at the end and really get a good look at him. And so they inserted these things. And the director and the writer, a guy named Bennett, were really upset about that. And I was watching the movie earlier tonight. It's a wonderful movie, which I highly recommend. But at the same time, the weakest moments in it are the moments that they added where you actually see this demon. Because, first of all, it's not done particularly well. They had wanted Harry Harryhausen to do it, and he wasn't free at that moment, so I don't know who did it. But it's not a great-looking creature. And they don't do it well, and it definitely detracts from the movie. The movie is still wonderful and worth seeing, and based on that wonderful story called Casting the Runes by M.R. James. But it didn't help to actually see that. It would have probably been better without.
I had in that kind of vein, I had a network that reached out to me about 4 years ago, and they said, we want to do this series about exorcisms and about, you know, demons. And I said, okay. And they said, we're going to go in and we're going to show this and we're going to show the actual exorcism. I said, well, most real Catholic priests are not going to allow you to film it. A, it could potentially be dangerous. You could be releasing God knows what into the ether, and especially all these people watching it at once.
Yeah.
And I said, and have you ever actually watched an exorcism? And they, well, no, but, you know, we've seen the movies. And I, well, it, you know, it doesn't always look like it does in the movies. And I said, what you'd probably be better suited doing is show the person go into the room with the priest and maybe sitting in the chair, and then the door slowly shuts, and then you just have them mic'd and allowed to be heard. And maybe while you're hearing that, you're showing photographs of them in happy moments. And they're like, why would we do that? We want to scare people. And I said, there's nothing more terrifying than seeing your neighbor smiling and hearing the sounds coming from the room. And
uh-huh.
I said, if you go to YouTube, there are videos up of exorcisms. They are the most ridiculous, silly-looking things as people are throwing themselves around.
Right.
And I'm not trying to belittle that, but the physical look of it is not intimidating. But there are, like, recordings of the Annalise Michel, you know, the real Emily Rose, I think it was, exorcism that went on. If you listen to the audio, it's terrifying. When your mind locks in and you start to picture what's going on in that room, it'll terrify you. And they ended up watching that, and they came back to me and they said, you're right, there's nothing we could do. If we put this on TV, flipping and flopping around, people are going to laugh at us, and it looks fake.
Yes, yes.
But TV's not going to take shutting the door and just hearing the sounds. And I said, that's a shame, because that will be the highest rated show they'll ever have. It will terrify the living hell out of people.
Right.
But TV, you know, they want to see the eyes rolling back and the head spinning, and that truthfully doesn't happen most exorcism cases that they're dealing with.
Did you happen to see the reissue of The Exorcist when they recut it and
yes.
released it? I'm hoping I'm getting the story right, but do you remember that there was an issue? William Peter Blatty had been very upset about several of the cuts that they had made, things that they had shot and then not included in the movie that was originally released. And when it was re-released at a longer length, he insisted that they include something which I felt he was absolutely right about and which had been lacking in the original issue. And that was, there's a scene in the reissue when they recut it that had been dropped. And it's an important scene, and it's very short, but I feel like in that entire movie, the one question that lingers in the audience's mind, and you always need to address the questions that might be there, that question was, why would the devil be going to this much trouble over one little girl? Why not just be done with it? And what's, you know, it seems such an inconsequential battle to be bringing Marin and Damien, those the two priests, into it. There is a scene which they put in the recut version, which I felt was really important, and Blatty was right. The two priests are on the stairs, Father Marin, the old priest, played by Max von Sydow, and Father Damien, the young, good-looking priest. And Damien asks, he says, why? Why all of this over one little girl? And Father Marin says, to teach us to despair. And I thought, there's an answer. There's an answer why. That it's the very triviality of it. One little girl in Georgetown, that the devil would go to all this trouble just to teach Father Marin, Damien, and others to despair. I thought, okay, whether you buy that or not, at least it had addressed a really salient question that I think was in the audience's mind, or at least was in mine and a lot of other people's.
Right, and it also puts you in the position of, you know, when children are in danger, that heightens the sense of terror, right? Yes. Because, again, then you're put in the situation of, whether you're a parent or not, nobody wants to see a child going through a torturous moment like that. And to hear them address the fact that, you know, hey, why this? Well, that's where it's going to make the most impact. You go and possess the president or possess an old retiree, it's probably not as high a risk as it is to see a child being tossed about and thrown about and giving you the real sense of, look what I can do, and there's nothing you can do to stop this right now. Yeah, and that's got to get ready to break priests down, right? Because they're watching a child just being tossed around like a rag doll.
Yeah, and that's it, to teach us to despair. I mean, in my own novels and stuff, the things I can barely do is I can't inflict trouble and danger and pain on children or animals. You know, I mean, sometimes for plot reasons you have to, but I try not to. I mean, I'm one of those guys, if I go to a movie, I don't care if 100 people die, but like, is the collie okay? Did the dog get through?
That's like the Walking Dead. Every week we watch people killing each other, we watch zombies eating humans, and the one episode where the three dogs come out of the woods kind of growling and snarling at our heroes, and then we hear the gunfire, and then they're all sitting around the fire eating. Everybody's put off by that idea. And you're like, well, it's survival at this point. No, why did you kill the dog? Dogs. And
they can't help it. They were just badly trained.
Exactly. When the Halloween movie came out, I remember that in 1977, when that movie came out, I remember what was so funny to me was how many people were upset by the death of a dog in the movie. But nobody mentions the 13 teenagers that are brutally butchered throughout the movie.
Yeah. Teenagers, you've seen one, you've seen them all.
They had it coming. All that sex and drugs, right? The dog was just doing his job barking at Michael Myers.
Michael Myers and Freddy, this is heresy what I'm about to say, but they never really scared me. The ones that don't scare me are the ones like Michael Myers and Freddy's nightmares and all that stuff. If you've got a creature and they keep coming back, you think they're dead, there seems to be no way to kill them. They're killed, but they're not ever killed. I need some kind of a logic to my stories. I need to know what the rules are. Because after a certain point, you know, after Donald Pleasance had shot Michael Myers 18 times, and he still keeps shooting at him, I'm thinking, have we learned nothing? You know, he's going to get up. No matter what you do, he's going to get up. You can set him on fire. He's going to keep walking. It just becomes scary to me.
We have to take a break. We'll continue talking and discussing this. Robert Micello, my guest. Stay tuned. More of the best in overnight talk radio continues. I'm Dave Schrader, and this is Coast to Coast AM.